Let's go back to the 138th Psalm. David apparently never ceases in his many opportunities to glorify the Lord. He is indeed, in the page of Scripture, the great worshiper of the Lord. And I'm thankful for his wonderful example that he leaves us, and the Lord's blessings in allowing us to partake of the great treasures of the book of Psalms. We left off at a very interesting point last time, that though God be so high, verse 6, though the Lord be high, that is, he is lifted up above all things, yet hath he respect to the lowliest of his creation. And we went back to Psalm 113. That's where we left off last time. I do want to go back there, because we've already seen this point previously in the 113th Psalm and others as well. But this psalm was very pointed. Verse 4, the Lord is high above all nations, and his glory above the heavens. God is to be exalted because he is exalted above everyone, above everything. Who is like unto the Lord our God, who dwelleth on high. And I said last time that we as believers need to be reminded that there is more to this creation than just earth and the things on the earth. We're prone to think by our behavior that everything that's important is instigated by earth and going on the earth, and that's pretty much it. Well, that's the view of those who don't know the Lord. That's how they live their life, as if God doesn't exist and there's nothing to be concerned about more than earth. That's why you see this worship of the earth and all these desires for things to happen down here. But the fact is, there are more important things in this life than just doing life and all of what that entails. There is one who is above the life of humans, the one who controls all things in the affairs of all humanity. And it is he who is to be exalted above all things pertaining to this earth and to this life. There is one who is above the life of humans. And since that's true, then we on earth must understand that the one who is above all life and the life of humans is the one who is most important to humans, because he controls all things in the affairs of all humanity. From the beginning of the earth, which he hath made, to the end of it all, and to the end of all things as we know it down here, God is to be exalted in all the earth. And it is a fitting note of praise for the Lord of creation. Verse 5, who is like unto the Lord our God, who dwelleth on high? The answer is no one. No one dwells on high but God, because there is no one like God. Who else sits in the heavens of heavens and controls all things? Who else is sovereign and has created all things after the counsel of his own will and pleasure? Who else has created these things to do what he has determined from all eternity, even before the world began? No created thing could usurp the Creator. The thought of it is sheer insanity. Verse 6, who humbleth himself to behold the things that are in heaven and in earth. He controls it, and he's concerned about it. He controls every aspect of every single thing in the entire universe, all living creatures on earth, all the angelic hosts in heaven, everything. And he controls it from the throne of heaven, and yet he takes it upon himself to look to his own creation and is concerned about it, even though it is affected by the ravages of sin. So knowledgeable is he that even He knows the count of every hair on our head. We don't even know that much, and it's our head. And that example is just a minuscule fact of how deep God knows all there is to know about us. And that's going to come very important in the 139th Psalm. Trust me when I tell you. We're going to really learn some things that, well, we'll learn them when we get there. This God is so high and lifted up that he observes the frailty and the sinfulness of man. Yet the same God observes the actions of every individual person, the sinner and the saint, and should be glorified for that as well. That God who sits above the heavens should be mindful of sinful man is an act worthy of praise to God. That he would even care about a sinner is an act worthy of praise. And Spurgeon wrote, heathen philosophers could not believe that the great God was observant of the small events of human history. They pictured him as abiding in serene indifference to all the wants and the woes of his creatures. People believe that now about God. They think that's what he is. He's indifferent, because they keep asking the stupid question, why does God allow X, Y, and Z? The question should be, why did we? There are a lot of things that we have done, and we're reaping the consequences for them, and then we're asking, why doesn't God do something? Well, you decided you didn't want him, that you could live your life without him, so go ahead. This is the consequence of your choosing to reject God and living your life without him. So enjoy your life. Enjoy your consequence. They think that God is indifferent, that he's in heaven and he could care less what we want. Well, that's because you don't know him. Our rock is not as their rock. We have a God who is high above all gods, or all that is called God, and yet who is our Father, knowing what we have need of before we ask him, our shepherd who supplies our needs, our guardian who counts the hairs on our head, our tender and considerate friend who sympathizes in all of our griefs. Truly, the name of our condescending God should be praised wherever it is known. End of quote. The point is that God is approachable, and that he would do so is worthy of praise to him. He doesn't have to do it. There is nothing that obligates God to approach humanity, which by nature despises him. But he does it anyway. He is the incomparable one who has set up his throne in the heights, but at the same time directs his gaze deep downwards in the heavens and upon earth. Nothing in all the realm of the creatures that are beneath him escapes his sight. Nothing is so low that it remains unnoticed by him. Again, that's going to be real important truth in the 139th Psalm. I'm reminded the last time I flew, long time ago. You can see as you take off, I like sitting by the window seat. I like seeing stuff. Make sure the wings are still in the plane. Make sure the engine doesn't fall off. Make sure there's no gremlins. All that kind of stuff. You notice as fast as you get up, you notice that cars get real small real quick, houses and what have you. Now from that vantage point, you're looking out and you could see everything is so small. In fact, it's so small to you, you can't see it. You just see lights. At night, you see lights. It's just patches of lights and darkness. Then during the day, there's all kinds of things that you see. You really can't discern too much. That's why the pilot comes on and tells you, that's Nevada, that's Colorado, that's Iowa. On that side, that's New Jersey. You can't see it. He's flying a map. That's why he knows it. Or he's flown the route so many times, he knows it in his mind and heart. Now, sure, I'm high, I'm lifted up because of the plane, and I can look down and I can see a whole lot more than I can see by just walking on the ground. But the enormous difference between me and that plane and God up in heaven is the fact that I'm in a plane and God's up in heaven. And when he looks down, He not only sees the earth, he can see every single person at one time on that earth. He knows every single number of hairs on the head of every person. He knows the thoughts of every single individual. He knows the core, the heart, the soul of every single person. Yet he sits in the heavens. He knows our thoughts afar off. He knows everything there is to know about us. So his gaze is fantastic. It's beyond comprehension. Period. He's approachable. He's incomparable. He directs his gaze deep downwards in the heavens and upon the earth. Nothing in all the realm of the creatures that are beneath him escapes his sight, and nothing is so low that it remains unnoticed by him. He is keenly aware of all matters in the heavens and the earth. No other being is like unto God to any degree, and he is to be praised for that fact. God is absolutely unique. He is God alone. Now go back to Psalm 138. He is God alone. Verse 6 again, though the Lord be high, yet hath he respect unto the lowly, but the proud he knoweth afar off. The Lord is totally familiar with the lowly in ways that no one else can be. And God is going to make us to understand that fact so that we can grow in him. The point is that our intellect, just the point I want to make here, is that our intellect is not enough for us, and that it is not a substitute for the experience that God has with his people. And David's been saying all along that he's had such tremendous experiences with God in different levels, that God has respect unto the lowly, that he's not just looking upon us and gazing upon us, but he's actively involved for the benefit of those who are humble. And that's a truth that intellectually people want to grasp hold of, but they don't want to really believe it in terms of any personal experience. And our intellect, from what I'm seeing in these Psalms, and from what I'm seeing in the Bible, and how these folks continue to interact with God, that our intellect is not enough for us, and it is not a substitute for the experience that God has with his people. God has a true and wonderful relationship with his people. It's continual, it's daily, it's every moment, it's not going anywhere. If you feel like God is not there, it's your fault. Anytime you feel like God is not present, it's your fault. You moved, you did something, it's you. Because when you look at Scripture, the relationship that God has with his people is so unique, it's so supernatural, it's not something that humans can produce or can even maintain, let alone produce it. Now, I want to read something that might seem a bit out the way, but there's a purpose in it, and it goes to what I said a moment ago, that our intellect is not enough for us, and it is not a substitute for the experience that God has with his people, because we really need to have growing our personal experience with the Lord. I read an article recently, it kind of struck me, on the failure of the liberal public school system. And one of the salient points that was made by the author is that Americans don't even have basic skills for simple comprehension. That's bad enough. If you don't have comprehension skills, you can't do anything. And if that's true in the natural, and it is, how much more is it true in the spiritual? One of the solutions that was offered had to do with something even greater than book learning that we failed to achieve. So there is such a tremendous failure at the level of basic skills for comprehension. They were saying that Americans could barely read the commentaries in newspapers and understand what the author was trying to say, that we don't even have that kind of comprehension. There was a very high figure that most Americans do not have basic skills of comprehension. They don't have much skills of anything. this bunch of big spoiled babies. I was somewhere today. Where was I today? I guess I was. Yeah, I was at the. Huh? Yeah, I think that was it. Well, it's not a comprehension skill, it's a deprivation skill, I guess. But I kept hearing. No, it was over here. I was hearing this. There was a car driving by and a girl sticking her head out. She was just screaming and screaming and screaming. And then yesterday, I was watching a couple of kids and the lady was saying to the kid, "Now, I told you about this four times already, and you're not making me happy." And I just kept thinking, you know, when I grew up, it would have been the first time. And that would have, it wouldn't have been a matter of happiness at that point. It would have been a matter of you comprehending that you shouldn't do X, Y, and Z. And I kept thinking, as I always do, that these are the same kids that are going to one day run businesses and corporations, and they're going to be in control of whatever. And I've been saying that for years. I'm watching a society that not only is intellectually bankrupt, but it's just rotten spoiled. You know, if you raise a kid to be a rotten spoiled brat, they're going to be a rotten spoiled adult. That's what they're going to be. And nothing's going to change that. And you have a whole society of these kinds of people without any kind of intellect. They've been given whatever they want because they're spoiled, so they're used to getting whatever they want. But then they run into people like me that don't give them anything because they don't deserve anything because they're here. You know, because they're on the planet doesn't mean that they deserve something. What is that supposed to mean? You have to earn your keep. But they don't have comprehension skills. They don't understand that because you're here and your mama and your daddy gave you everything doesn't mean that your boss has to give you anything. You have to earn what you make. You have to earn your keep. You know, you don't go to school and expect to get a graduate degree not having done the work. Although, you find on the webpage there are those who will give you degrees and diplomas with no work. That's part of that society, that spoil, that comes up with these clever ways of giving you paperwork so you can go get jobs that you don't know anything about. Well, anyway, the author was saying that we need to even go further than just having comprehensive knowledge, book knowledge, which is good, but it's not sufficient. And I thought that's a good point, too. And he said this, quoting, "You cannot confront the crises of life with just book learning." And he gives a couple of examples. If you fall down a crevice on a mountain and your yacht sinks in a hurricane, you need more than a rational appreciation of natural hazards to survive. You know, yeah, you know, I'm in pain now. You know, I can see that nature is a real foreboding thing to have to deal with, but you're going to need more than that. You need practice and actual experience in decision making under duress so that your rational knowledge becomes internalized as an instinct. That's what we need in the church. We need to practice and experience decision making under duress. This is what David was doing. You see him doing all the right things in stressful situations, with his enemies chasing him, with them wanting to kill him. That's the constant context of Psalms over and over and over again, which gets dismissed, which proves that a lot of people fail to utilize, frankly, basic skills for simple comprehension. Because if he's talking about his enemy, he's not talking about your job. If he's talking about being killed, he's not talking about, you know, whatever it is you want to talk about. You didn't get that raise. He's not talking about that. He's talking about something that is right there. His enemies are hounding him. They want him dead. He's experiencing all kinds of afflictions and whatnot. He's surrounded by death, and now he trusts God, and God delivers him. That's what's being said over and over and over again. And so we forget that. We take Psalms like Psalm 23. Death all in that Psalm. We forget all about it. And then we make it, you know, some little nice little poem for us to deal with our little bad day. I got a headache. Guys, it's going to quote Psalm 23. Well, the shadow of death is not referring to, you know, the pain in the back of your neck. It's death. Death is there for a reason. The valley of the shadow of death. That's not an insignificant statement, a metaphor for your headache. Okay? I will fear no evil. Why do you think he said that? Basic comprehension would tell you, there's something evil going on. We just do that stuff. We do it Romans 8:28. We do it Philippians 2. We do it all over the place. And so if we don't have basic comprehension skills of what we're reading, we're not going to have any kind of experiential skills to be able to deal with life. Because you know what? Life is going to knock you down. Life isn't going to be the way you want it. Listen, you think your life, because you set in motion a set of circumstances which in your deception protects you from the environment, whatever, you're nuts. Your life can change like that, and there's nothing you can do about it. And you need more than just book knowledge to be able to deal with it. You need practice and actual experience in decision-making under duress so that your rational knowledge becomes internalized as an instinct, so that instinctively you can know what to do. And what does David show us? He instinctively went to God every time. A lot of us don't know what to do about anything. It's like something happens and we have to find a clue as what we ought to do. That's because there's been no practice and actual experience in decision making to either degree, under duress or not. So our rational knowledge, this comprehension, the basic skills of comprehension become internalized, becomes a part of us. It becomes instinctive in us. What you have to keep doing. This is life. That's real life. How do you handle these things? If it's just in your head, then you're going to have a problem. And he goes on to say that's the way they teach you to fly airplanes. When the weather starts to close in, good pilots must combine knowledge, skill, experience, and judgment to make the decision that will get him out of a jam. The same applies to ordinary life crises like losing a job or getting divorced. What do you do when these tragedies happen? What do you do? What do you fall back on? What is on the inside of you? What has become internalized instinctively? What do you do? And most folks have no clue. They don't know what to do. And that's bad enough for someone in the world, but it's horrific when it becomes the issue of a Christian. Because we have so many examples of what to do. But the example itself is not sufficient. We have to have the experience. And see, a lot of professing believers say, a lot of so-called churches, it seems like their job is to protect people from life. So they become totally unprepared for life. And I thought about this today. I said, Lord, I hope I'm not losing my mind. But I tell you, I am so glad that I went through all the experiences I went through dealing with religious people all these years. All the bad in particular. Because it honed and it taught me things about people in general. The best and worst of people. It taught me a lot of things about them and about myself. I would not be able to deal with the kinds of people that I have to deal with on a continual basis. And I have been. Unless I went through some practice and experience and decision making under the rest of people. Y'all have no clue. I tell you these things, but you don't know by your experience because you haven't been there. But it's been something. But instinctively, when I deal with people, because I've dealt with them for over 30 years, it's like, oh, come on. This is easy. It's easy for me because I've been there. It may not be easy for you to know or have an idea what to do. Point is, in the article, the quotation I read, is that we have some in the church who are more than willing to sit down and attempt to survive with what little intellect that they think they have when it comes to Bible application and life's experiences. See, and I've said this for years. In all churches I've ever pastored, I've said the same thing. So this isn't anything new. There are people who are more than willing to sit down and listen. That's all they want to do. They want to come to a church and they want to listen. That's their ministry, sitting down and listening. They have no intention of doing anything you tell them, but they are happy and content, and their mind tells them that's sufficient. Just sit down in the church and be there. Do nothing, say nothing, minister to no one. I'm here. And that's sufficient. They have no life experience. They have no biblical application. They can't survive anything. And the intellect they think they have in their minds, which really don't, is that's a deception too. They can't survive with it. But sad to say that most of us refuse to practice actual experience and decision making under duress so that our rational knowledge becomes internalized as an instinct. We don't know what to do. So what do we do instead? Well, we continue to settle in on having God in our minds and not in our lives. And so when crisis happens, we don't know how to do what we have been taught to do in any given situation. We don't know how to do anything. I guarantee you, I'm sure I haven't missed anything in all these years. I'm certain. I think I covered the gamut of everything that's pretty much important because we went through the Bible enough to know. I think we've covered everything that's important. I think I covered. If I've missed something, write me a note. Let me know. If you don't really want to know me to know who you are, then type it on a computer and just slip it somewhere and I'll get it and keep it anonymous. But I think I covered every section of your life and mine that I think is important. Okay, so what have we done with it? When those things I talked about have come to pass, what do? Like we forgot. That proves the point. We just can't keep sitting here and gobble up knowledge and then forget about it. And then when something happens, we don't know what to do. When as a decision has been made, we don't know what to do. We make a right or wrong decision we don't even know. You can't survive like that. You just can't lollygag and float around in life and expect things just to be the right way. That's not the model of Scripture. That's not someone who's thinking. You have to think. You have to practice. You have to put this truth and these things you're getting into practice. And life has given us plenty of opportunities, but we have run from the practice. We have run from the experience. Because it's easier to run from it. That way I don't have to suffer the pain of learning anything in it. It's easier to bypass the pain. We just kind of tolerate the circumstance, tolerate the situation, tolerate the person, tolerate. That's called compromise. That's called the death to your knowledge of God, this truth. And we've suffered. So now when something happens, oh my goodness, we got to call somebody. You've already been taught what to do, but you've dismissed it. And all those ducking and dodgings of all the experiences that you needed to get you to the place in your mind and heart where God wanted you to be, it's all gone. Now you don't know what to do. All the trials here, all the suffering there, all those moments where you had to hold on to your faith, and that's all you had, faith in God, faith that he was going to do for you what you believed him to do for his glory. You let that go. And that's when you were strong, when you held on, and God was so real to you and so wonderful and ministered to you marvelously. You let that go. And God was bringing this trial and this test and this experience, and you just ducked them all. And all those tests and trials and what have you, God was going to use in some way to benefit the lives of other people, to use you to touch lives, and you messed up. Now you sin. You cannot, nor will not, survive on book knowledge alone. If we do not believe in our experience that God is God, we are finished before we even begin this life as professing believers. The point is, if we do not believe that God is God, and we don't believe God is God, if we don't have an experiential walk with him, we certainly don't believe it. You know, okay, what our mouths are saying, it's what we are, what we do. And certainly, we're done. It's nothing. It's a waste of time. Can't survive. And we'll look for more reasons to comfort and fortress me and avoid everything. It'll be job and home, and that's life. No one else matters. No one else's life matters. And your life won't matter. God is not indifferent to his own. We are indifferent to God for reasons that make no sense. though the Lord be high, yet hath he respect unto the lowly. As concerning God, he is concerned towards the poor, and he respects the poor. He has no respect for the wicked, in language that is rather clear to understand. He knoweth them afar off. It's not that the Lord does not see them, or that he does not know their every thought and motive, okay, and what they do. It is that when it comes to his decision to regard them, he has no regards for them. Because the proud, by their arrogance, act and live as if they do not need God in their lives. Stop. Said that before. The proud, by their arrogance, act and live as if they do not need God in their lives. That's why God has no regard for them. He let them go on. If they want to live as if they don't need him, God says, go right ahead. So God accommodates them by removing his help and mercy from them, and rather lines them up for judgment. So he removes his help from them, okay, and his mercy from them. And then he lines them up for his judgment. He doesn't remove his help and mercy and then makes them neutral. Oh, God is not passive. God is not passive. For God resisteth the proud, but gives grace unto the humble. God stands against the proud. Which is a quotation from Psalm 334. Surely he scorneth the scorners, but he giveth grace unto the lowly. Same passage. In fact, twice in the New Testament, this verse is quoted and translated. God stands against the proud, but gives and keeps on giving, grammatically speaking, grace to the humble. God keeps giving grace to the humble person. So when it comes to the proud man or woman, God beholds them at a distance and has them in utter derision or scorn. God isn't mildly displeased with the proud. I recall Proverbs 6. The first thing God hates is what? A proud look. God hates pride. He hates a proud person. He hates a proud man or woman. He sets them in utter derision. He sets them in scorn. They're not in any of his favor. One writer said it this way. The proud are such who are proud of themselves and what they have, of their wisdom and knowledge, of their strength or beauty, of their wealth and riches, or of their righteousness and holiness, of the purity and goodness of their hearts and power of their free will. They vainly think themselves possessed of and despise others below them in these things or the practice of them. These the Lord takes notice of and looks upon them at a distance with scorn and contempt, nor will he admit them to nearness to him, nay, opposes himself to them, and sooner or later abases them. God sees the context that this writer is talking about is religiously. I mean, they trust themselves, their religion, their faith, their profession, their alleged righteousness, their holiness, their own goodness, their free will to do whatever they want. They think they're possessed of God, but they're not. And then that pride just pours out, and they start looking down upon people and just despising people rather than loving them, rather than understanding. But with practical experience, you were like them, but for the grace of God, you still be like that person. You need to have compassion on that person. You need to have the love of Christ in that person, and you can't if you love yourself. And God takes notice of that person, and he treats them with scorn. And he has judgment lined up for the proud. Spurgeon said, though the Lord be high in greatness, in dignity, and power, Jehovah is higher than the highest. His nature is high above the comprehension of his creatures, and his glory even exceeds the loftiest soarings of imagination. Yet hath he respect unto the lowly. He views them with pleasure, thinks of them with care, listens to their prayers, and protects them from evil. Because they think little of themselves, he thinks much of them. They reverence him, and he respects them. They are low in their own esteem, and he makes them high in his. But the proud he knoweth afar off. He does not need to come near them in order to discover their utter vanity. A glance from afar reveals to him their emptiness and offensiveness. He has no fellowship with them, but views them from a distance. He is not deceived, but knows the truth about them. Despite their blustering, he has no respect unto them, but utterly abhors them. To a Cain's sacrifice, a Pharaoh's promise, a Rabshakeh's threat, and a Pharisee's prayer, the Lord has no respect. Nebuchadnezzar, when far off from God, cried, "Behold, this great Babylon which I have builded." But the Lord knew him and sent him grazing with cattle. Proud men boast loudly of their culture and the freedom of thought, and even dare to criticize their maker. But he knows them from afar and will keep them at arm's length in this life and shut them up in hell in the next. End of quote. The greatest fool who walks this earth is the proud man or woman, whatever their status on earth, for they are beyond divine help by their own choosing. God says, "I have help that you need. I'm the help you need. You're in need of my redemption. You're in need of my salvation. You're in need of my remedy, because there's no remedy apart from me." God says, it's not a remedy that's separate from me. I'm the remedy. So to come to the remedy that I offer, you have to come to me. Proud man or woman says, "I don't need you. I'm a good person," blah, blah, blah. And they don't have to literally say it, though some do. Most don't. They just live like that. They just live their lives as if they don't need the Lord. Greatest fool who walks this earth is a proud man or woman, whatever their status on earth, for they are beyond divine help by their own choosing. They choose not to have God as their help. They criticize God. That's a proud person. I don't criticize God at all. I criticize humanity, who is worthy of criticism all the time. And we act like we're so good. Please, on your best day, on the best day of your life, which will probably be when you're sleeping, you are still evil before God. On your best day, God is still infinitely greater than you, and you are still worthy of criticism. But their hearts are so full of themselves that they have drowned in their own sinfulness. I've known some people, pictures, visions in my mind of people I used to know and still do, who are proud. Incredible. Incredible vanity. I remember one man told me, "I don't need you." I'll never forget that day. He calls me for advice, and then I gave him the advice that he needed. And then he got angry. I said, "Well, before you hang up, these things are going to happen. This and this and this." And 6 months later, everything I told him happened exactly the way I told him, in the exact order I told him. He called back. Act like I didn't say anything to him. And he told me, "This happened, and this happened, and this happened, and this happened." And I said, "Now, 6 months ago, we had this discussion. It was real quiet. He didn't say anything, because he knew. He was done. 6 months ago, we had this conversation. And I told you, this could happen, and this, and this, and everything happened by your own mouth, exactly the way that you said it was going to happen, exactly in the order that I told you was going to happen. But yet, you won't even acknowledge that God spoke to you about it." It's real quiet. Didn't say a word. I said, "I think it's sad that you will not give God glory for what he showed you." "I don't need you. I don't need you at all to tell me anything." And he just went on. And I said, "Oh, truth comes out now, doesn't it? Truth came out now, brother." "Oh, no, no." I said, "That's all right. That's all right. I got the message. I got it. You don't have to tell me twice. I haven't spoken to him since. Because I don't deal with proud people. They're wasting my time. They're self-sufficient. And his pride exceeds, I think, more than any other person I've ever, this man, and he's in the ministry. His pride just exceeds, and he thinks himself to be great. It's amazing. So I told you everything was going to happen. I don't need you. I just talked to you. I don't need you. Tell me. You don't need to. I just talked to you to make you feel good." "Oh, well. And I'm feeling real good about now, because it's going to be our last conversation." "No, no, you don't have to do that." "Yes, I do. Because you've already expressed that you don't have any need of my fellowship. You want them lackeys to keep lying to you. I'm just here to tell you the truth, which is what I told you when I first met you, but that's fine. You know, let's move on to something else. You do your life, you and your pride and what have you, and that's fine. Drowning in the sinfulness. There's no greater sinner than the proud, for he or she needs no help according to themselves. And the worst of the proud thinks that he or she has a relationship with the very God who stated that he not only does not have any relationship with them, but the same God stated in Proverbs 6 that he hates the proud. How could this man or woman be blinder than this? How can a man or woman say that they have a relationship with a God who hates the very pride that they are oozing out all over the place? How stupid is that? That's blind. God has no regard, none whatsoever, for the proud, for the lofty. None at all. He knows them afar off. He hates them. That's what he said. But there are people in churches who think they have a relationship with God, and they're proud men and women, and God says, I hate that person, even in the church. I don't care if they're in the church or out. I still hate them. I hate them more in the church because they act like they have a relationship with me when they know they don't. They know they don't. The intent is to fool other people. God is not fooled. God is never fooled. I wait till we get to Psalm 139. I mean, he gets right into some real, you know, thou hast searched me and known me. Thou knowest my downsitting and my uprising. Thou understandest my thoughts afar off. Thou compass my path and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. God knows. For there is not a word in my mouth, but lo, O Lord, thou knowest it altogether. You already knew it. Before I even said it, Lord, you know it. For thou hast beset me behind and before and laid thine hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is high. I cannot attain unto it. Whither shall I go from thy spirit? Whither shall I flee from thy presence? If I ascend up to heaven, thou art there. If I make my bed in hell, behold, thou art there. If I take the wings of the morning and dwell in the uttermost parts of the sea, even there shall thy hand lead me, and thy right hand shall hold me. Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That's a great song. God knows everything. The intricate details of our life. And people act like God knows nothing. The Lord would say, I know you. You don't know me. That's the problem. I can say all this about you, that I know every intricate detail of you, but you can't say that about me for sure. Verse 7, though I walk in the midst of trouble, thou wilt revive me. Thou shalt stretch forth thy hand against the wrath of mine enemies, and thy right hand shall save me. There we go again. The context deals with the enemies of the psalmist. This verse sounds like Psalm 23. Do I walk in the midst of trouble? Thou will revive me. Thou shalt stretch forth thy hand against the wrath of mine enemies. Thy right hand shall save me. In Psalm 23, the psalmist stated that though he walk through the shadow of death, or the valley of the shadow of death, he would fear no evil, for thy rod and thy staff comforted him. In Psalm 138, he stated that though he would walk through or among dire straits or trouble, the midst of trouble, the center of dire conditions, not around them, but in the center of them, that they would surround him and nowhere to go. God would revive him, meaning that the Lord would preserve his life. The implication that the dire condition imposed by his enemies was designed to have him killed. Again, another clear context. Enemies, death, not a bad day, and I got my hair color the wrong color. Or I had an ingrown toenail, or someone, you know, hit me in the head by mistake. I, you know, got my toe stepped on the elevator. Woe is me. Or someone messed with my cubicle, or whatever. We're a bunch of babies. Can't deal with life. And that's not even life. That's nothing. Someone took my paper clips. Get some more. They weren't yours anyway. They're the company's. Someone took my pen. I mean, I remember working the phone, folks having fights over pens. It's a whole cabinet full of them in there. Get two or three of them. Lock them in your drawer. Fighting over a pen. The pen wasn't the problem. They just had words. The pen wasn't an excuse. Fighting arguments. What are they fighting? They're fighting over a pen. No, they're not. The pen is the excuse. They're about ready to stab each other with the pen. Big old bunch of babies. Can't that to them is life? Someone takes their pencil? That's a dire condition. These folks are willing to go to jail because someone honks a horn at them? Someone looks at them the wrong way? They're looking past you. They weren't looking at you. Is it that important? The cable guy's not here on time. You want to kill him? The guy gives you the wrong cut of meat. You want to kill the butcher? That's dire conditions to people. They lost their minds. They don't even know how to deal with things that happen that are accidents, real mistakes. They shorted you a nickel. What, do you want to sue? That's a dire condition? You want to start pulling out some Bible for that? We ain't been through nothing to be pulling out no Bible. Grabbing all these Psalms. I'm just comforting the Psalms, Lord, because you said, though I walk in the midst of trouble, Lord, I'm in trouble now. Lord, I'm in trouble. No, no. You're going to revive me. That's what you said in your word. You'll tell God what he said in his word like he don't know. You don't know. That's a stretch forth the hand against the wrath of my enemies. They came against me. Let them give back my dollar. You know, when she took my pencil to keep it, lost, she my enemy. People are insane. He said that God would stretch out his hand against the anger of his enemies, that God's right hand would deliver him. That right hand we have already seen is representative of God's incredible power. No matter what his enemies threw at him, God was there to handle it, and he did handle it. Turn to Psalm 56. I said this before. I'm going to say it again. I'm going to keep saying it. You folks have not had enemies like I've had. The worst enemies you could ever have are church folk. Church folk, your worst enemy. Because they think they have a relationship with God. That makes them even more of an enemy than you could ever imagine. And there are times where I wanted to act. God knows. And I've said this. And I just said, Lord, you have to deal with it. And for years, it just looked like they had the upper hand. They just kept coming. Coming. Said this, said that, said the other. And some of the effects are still felt to this day. There are still some people who listen to the lie and will not talk to me. I'm still the same person. I can't help what they do. If they will listen to a lie, there's nothing I can do about it. But I watched God take every one of the enemies down. I have to do nothing but just say, Lord, they're your enemies too. You know I had nothing to do with this, Lord, so I'm trusting in you. And if I did, let me know. And God handled it. And he did handle it. Because he promised he would do that. Verse 5, every day they wrest my words, twist my words. All their thoughts are against me for evil. Again, the context is his enemies. That's not the person in the cubicle whose hair looks better than yours today. You know, because she went on ahead to the hairdresser. She had the money you didn't. So she got the raise because her hair looked good. Boss lust after she got the raise you didn't. You had a little nappy today. Or whatever the case may be. That's not a dire condition for you to lose your money. I'm going to lose, lay my religion down. I need to get saved. That's not nothing. It's a nothing. It's nonsense to be doing that kind of stuff. They gather themselves together. They hide themselves. They mark my steps. When they wait for my soul, they're following me. Shall they escape by iniquity? In thine anger cast down the people, O God. Thou tellest my wanderings. Put thou my tears into thy bottle. Are they not in thy book? When I cry unto thee, then shall mine enemies turn back. This I know, for God is with me. When I cry. The word when refers to time. In other words, any time, day and night, when the psalmist cried out to God, God would cause the enemy to turn away. He rested his case with the assurance that the Lord would hear and respond in justice. When the Lord came to the rescue of his people, the enemies would be in retreat. He said, by this I know that God is for me. Amazing. Go back again to, let's go to verse 10 here. Verse 10. In God will I praise his word, in the Lord will I praise his word. There we go. Repeated it twice in this verse. He used both Elohim and Jehovah in this passage. He made his boast in the Lord and his word no matter what happened. In God I put my trust. I will not be afraid what man can do unto me. What's a man going to do? I put my confidence in God. Why do I need to worry about what a person's going to do? He would not be afraid of a single person, and he would not be afraid of the creation of man, of mankind. His confidence was continuing to build up during his trouble, so it didn't matter what people were doing. His confidence built up. He had personal experience with God that kept building, kept growing all the time. And that's why his confidence was built up. He gained more confidence. We who have no confidence have no trials. So there's no reason to employ all this wonderful protection of God if there's no enemies. Why? If your life is the way you like it and everything is the way it is, everything, why should you cry out to God for enemies? That's why I said prayer life is very small when this doesn't happen. When you have everything the way you want it, your prayer life is about 5 seconds. Why should it be any longer than 5 seconds? Lord, lay me down to sleep. Pray the Lord my soul to keep. Five star, four way prayer. Amen. Why go any further than that? You got everything you want. Why should you ask God to give you strength during a trial when you have no trial? What trial? What, payroll's a day late? I gotta have, okay, well, that's your dire circumstance, you know. There's a long line at the gas station. Well, not now. I gotta wait in this, you know, you got your cart, you're in Costco, and you see like 47 people in each line. You got that one line, and you running, dun, 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 you trying to get to that line. And 86 other people are in the same place. You didn't pay no money. There's a big old collision shop because that's your dire strait for the day. That's your trial. Or you get one of them long lines and you see the lady, you know what she's going to do, but you can't ask her. And she goes to everybody in the line but you and go, why don't you come over the line? We're opening up a new, and you lose it because that's your trial. You cuss somebody up. The person behind you saw you at church the other day. Mm-hmm. This is your trial or test. All this over nothing. All this is a waste of time. There is no test. There is no trial. What enemies? What enemies do you have? Why do you need to employ all this wonderful strength of God during tests that don't exist? Why should we take what God says contextually in the word here that refers to trials and testing and duress because of people persecuting you, and that we take that wonderful truth, ignore the context that comes in, and then take the truth and put it in our life of ease? You know, I couldn't get it in that line today. Or they got the last supper. I was just reaching for someone, snatched it. Do you want to snatch their throat? That's your trial for the day. Or you, I got my free phones. The trial I went through to get a free phone. Still trial, I'm being very facetious, but I tell you, it was crazy. Get the phones. Okay. Get two free phones. I've been with AT&T/Cingulus/LA Wireless/PacBell/whatever. Been with them for years. So I'm going to get free. So why? Just shut up and listen. Free phones. We call AT&T. Take an hour on the phone with them. One whole hour of my life gone. And she said, and I could have just, you know what she said? She said, I'm just so thankful. You've been so kind and patient with me. I wish I had all kinds of customers like you. Now, what if I had to act the fool 5 seconds before that? My mom said, act the fool. I said, no, act no fool. This is life. This is my life. Stuff like this happens all the time. So just go ahead and roll with it. Then you'll be blessed. And, you know, she said, okay, your order's done. Everything's fine. You should have the two phones in a couple of days. Get the box, one phone. It worked, one phone. Okay, I call AT&T. Spend another half hour, 45 minutes on the phone with another guy. Okay, he's thanking me. You're so patient. I'm going to give you $20 credit. So, okay, thank you. And he said, I'm going to send you out a phone. Fine. No, he said, I'm going to give you a $68 credit. I said, fine, whatever. I'll send you out the phone. Yes, they got two phones. Like, why do I have two phones now? I didn't order three. I only ordered two phones. I got one. Why do I got two more now? So I call AT&T back. You sent me three phones. I only ordered two. Oh, you know, you're so patient. I'm going to give you $20 credit. I said, okay, works for me. I said, just what I do with this other phone? He said, I'm going to send you a prepaid mail you can take to the post office. And I'm going to give you $15 credit for gasoline because I know gas is tough. But so you just keep on crediting. Oh, you feel that, Jen? Go right ahead because I ain't going to act a fool. So why don't you go down to the phone store and have them change the SIM card so you can put the information on one SIM card to your new phone. They got a machine that could do it there. Go to there. Say, hi, you guys. Can you change the SIM card? You didn't know how long it took me to get there. Had to weed through all that traffic and find a parking space, what have you. He saw a machine broke. I said, oh, no, it's not. Don't tell me that. Now, that was no dire condition. That's life. Machines break down. He said, okay, you go to the one over here, and it ain't there anymore. So I'm just going home. Just going to go home. Went home. The next day, figured out how to do it myself. Did it myself. Everything's fine. What's the point? No point. It's just there's no dire condition. Ain't nothing to get all crazy about. It's nothing to lose your mind. It's a phone. Stupid stuff happens. You order two, you get one. You order one more, you get two. Stupid stuff happens. That's life. Get over yourself. You and the phone ain't that important. Because not that important. None of that. We need to really think about what we're doing. A lot of the stuff that we think is so critically important, it's zero. It doesn't matter. The only thing that matters is that which is spiritual, that we can make sure that our lives are in line with what the Bible teaches and are living it. I'm done. Father, thank you again for just showing us, Lord, that we need the practical experience, Lord, not just the comprehension skills and book knowledge. Lord, we've been ducking from the trials and tests, the true ones that are designed to help us to be what you want us to be. But we're never going to be that if we keep running away from the exam. Thank you, Lord, again for being merciful to us and for showing us your great love. Bless the giving tonight in Jesus' name. Amen.